From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Well, how do you define an anarcho-democracy? If anarcho-democracy means that the government is completely corrupt, the government is involved in drugs, the influence of drug traffickers reaches to the top levels of the government, then I said, well, then America is without a doubt anarcho-democracy.
More on the CIA crack-contra-crips connection. Tonight is the last presidential debate. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting lays out the relationship between the candidates, the moderator, and ADM, corporate criminal extraordinaire. And it's been 1 year since the Million Man March.
Now when they go back, the hottest ticket in the ghetto would be the brothers that didn't come, the lion say they was there. I was there, baby. And let me tell you what it was like.
We look back and ahead with Dr. Manning Marable. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Tonight's final presidential debate will be different than the one held 10 days ago in Connecticut. Unlike the conventional debate format, tonight's confrontation will be town hall style, while audience members get to ask unscreened questions. In fact, they themselves have been screened by the Gallup organization hired by the Commission on Presidential Debates. And the former Iran-Contra prosecutor is charging Bob Dole with hypocrisy. Lawrence Walsh notes the Republican presidential nominee has demanded President Clinton forego future pardons regarding Whitewater-related crimes, but he says Dole had a much different view concerning the Iran-Contra scandal in 1992. Walsh says Dole urged the pardon of a former Reagan cabinet officer for crimes of constitutional dimension while in office. President Bush later pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger for allegedly lying about his knowledge of the secret arms sale to Iran. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Radio personality and civil rights activist Joe Madison joined activist Dick Gregory in a hunger strike yesterday to pressure the U.S. government to admit that it played a role in the crack explosion in America. Madison and Gregory, as well as members of Congress, like California's Maxine Waters, are calling for an independent investigation and release of records related to charges raised in the San Jose Mercury News by investigative journalist Gary Webb. The series of articles called The Dark Alliance, What's Behind the Crack Explosion, reveal that the Central Intelligence Agency protected a Nicaraguan drug dealer who introduced crack into the black community of Los Angeles and funneled the profits to the Nicaraguan Contras so that the Contras could buy weapons to fight their war against the Sandinistas. Madison said his hunger strike is a small sacrifice compared to the sacrifices that the family of a crack addict makes. He said if it stops our communities from being sacrificed by those who turn a blind eye when illegal drugs are being dropped on our doorsteps, then I'll do it. Both Dick Gregory and Joe Madison were arrested twice last month outside the CIA and DEA, which demanding to meet with the heads of those agencies to discuss the revelations in the San Jose Mercury News series. Both the CIA and the Justice Department are looking into the charges. Well, Democracy Now! Has been covering this story every step of the way. And today we bring you some more background in this speech by Michael Levine, a former DEA agent who's written a book about his experiences called Deep Cover.
I have so much to tell you. During the last few days, it's been very interesting. Some DEA agent leaving Colombia made a statement that I don't think has been covered very much here in the press, but it caused an immense stir in Colombia, as it should have. The agent's name was Joe Toft, and Joe, on leaving after 7 years stationed in Colombia, said that the Colombian government is a narco-democracy and that they were totally corrupt. And suddenly, I don't know how Colombia discovered me, but the next thing I know, I was getting phone calls from all the media in Colombia, and they wanted to know what I had to say, about Colombia being a narco-democracy. And the first thing that I wanted to know is, well, how do you define a narco-democracy? If a narco-democracy means that the government is completely corrupt, the government is involved in drugs, the influence of drug traffickers reaches to the top levels of the government, then I said, well, then America is without a doubt a narco-democracy. And I received, after I said that, suddenly limos were showing up at my house, and they brought me down to New York to do Satélite. I've been doing, as you can tell. Y para la gente de habla hispana, después, si ustedes tienen la paciencia, yo les atiendo después, okay? Porque lo lamento mucho que no me esté traduciendo. I'm just apologizing for the people who speak Spanish. They can wait afterwards. I'll answer any questions they have. I want to tell you some of the things I told the Colombian people. I said, you know, it's funny that you ask, because my wife and I just wrote a book called La Gran Mentira Blanca. It doesn't translate well into Spanish, but it's called The Big White Lie. And I started off the book with the story of how I took part in a kidnapping for your government. You guys paid for it. Back in the 70s, we went down to Argentina posing as a soccer team, and we kidnapped three people. We brought them back to America with bags over their heads. One of the people, Yolanda Sarmiento, the Argentine police killed her son when they arrested her. The other two were beaten and tortured brutally. But you see, I at that time in my life, I had a brother who was a heroin addict. And my brother had been a heroin addict since he was 15. I grew up in the South Bronx. I saw drugs all around me. And my brother was one of the first victims. My brother lasted 19 years. After 19 years, my brother finally committed suicide. He wrote us a letter that said, "To my family and friends, I cannot stand the drugs any longer." And he put a bullet in his brain. Well, around the same time, our political leaders were telling me that it was not my brother's fault. Do you understand? It's not my brother's fault. It's not an American's fault that he takes drugs. It's the fault of some dark foreigner. They still tell us that. That's what the war on drugs is all about. We have to stop them from feeding us drugs, because if they do, then we can't resist. Listen to what they call it. They say it's a war on drugs. Say no to drugs, but drugs don't talk. How do you say no to drugs? They call it a drug plague. They call it an epidemic. What does this mean? Does this mean like I'm walking down the street and drugs get me? If you know, that's what our politicians tell us. Why? You know why? Because that's how you win votes. If somebody told me during the years that my brother, later my daughter, was a cocaine and crack addict, politicians to tell me the truth, to say, "Levine, it's your brother's fault. It's your daughter. Your brother puts dollars right into those cartel pockets. The cartel doesn't send salesmen around turning people on to drugs. They sell it. You know who turns people on to drugs? Your brother. Your daughter." But I wouldn't vote for anybody like that, because that's the truth. I'd rather hear that it's Pablo Escobar's fault. So, I told the people of Colombia, I said, you know, in this book, I described how I was stationed in Argentina. I was the country attaché, and I was also undercover. I spent the majority of my 25 years with DEA, passing myself off as a half-Sicilian, half Puerto Rican, representative of the mafia on a buying expedition that never ended. The expedition lasted for 25 years. And how I didn't know that there were that the true powers in the drug economy are protected. I didn't know. And a lot of DEA people don't know that. So I described how in the Big White Lie, for example, I was in Bolivia from 1978 to 1982, at a time when the drug demand was going nuts. Now, mind you, everybody, most Americans believe, because we need enemies, you know, we really need enemies. We have now 53 bureaucracies that are getting part of their budget under the war on drugs, under the banner of war on drugs, and we don't have a KGB anymore. You know, so everybody, the CIA, I read the other day, they're in part of the justification, because there's congressional hearings to see whether we should have a CIA. Well, part of their justification is they have to fight the war on drugs. But they don't mention that they got caught smuggling a ton of drugs in November. So who are they going to fight, themselves? It's going to be like a civil war? Well, I described how, and mind you, the Big White Lie is not an academician's book. It's not a journalistic study. It's all the conversations are tape recorded. It's the story of an undercover case. The events are backed up, documented the way only an experienced undercover agent can. I wrote it, hopefully, to testify before Congress or the Senate. But our Senate and our Congress is not very interested for a lot of reasons. We can go into that. I pointed out that what happened in the Big White Lie is that I witnessed the Central Intelligence of the United States supporting the takeover of Bolivia by drug dealers. Now, what is that? How is that significant to Colombia? Well, Bolivia was providing Colombia with 95% of the pasta básica, the raw materials that were in those years. So if you stopped Bolivia, you stopped Colombia, you stopped the drug traffic. And we were in position to do that. Pero entra the CIA. They killed the case. Of course, none of you guys were told that. They force transferred me out of South America, and the story is there. The interesting thing about the story is, and again, this is very important to anybody that's following Colombia, is that on October 26th of this past year, I had one of the rare opportunities to come out and talk to America. I got more coverage in Colombia during the last week than the whole time the Big White Lie has been out in America. And that's incredible. Because we need to know this, not just the Colombians too, need to know this. And on national television for 5 minutes, in sound bites, I said, I witnessed the Central Intelligence supporting ex-Nazis like Klaus Barbie, Argentine mass murderers, drug dealers. I witnessed them set up an organization called La Cooperación, the General Motors of cocaine, that to this day is supplying most of the cocaine base to Colombia. In the book, I describe how I worked alongside of a woman called La Reina de Coca. She was called the Queen of Cocaine by Pablo Escobar. Why? Because she was selling cocaine to Pablo Escobar. The only trouble is she was a CIA asset, which means the CIA was selling cocaine to Pablo Escobar. That devil, the man whose fault it is that we take cocaine. Well, a day later, for the first time in my life, the CIA did the unheard of. They trotted out Admiral Stansfield Turner, the ex-CIA chief, while I was down there, while I was down in stationed in South America. And the first thing he admitted on national television was that he hadn't read the book. Yeah. But he said, Central Intelligence would never do such a thing. They wouldn't support drug dealers. He couldn't even get them interested in working drug cases. And that's what America heard. That was the final word America heard. And the best I could do was to get on WBAI and say, that's a lie. If you didn't blink, 3 weeks passed, 3 weeks later, and on the front page of the New York Times, you saw Central Intelligence caught red-handed smuggling a ton of cocaine into the U.S. Then it was on 60 Minutes, and then it disappeared. So any radio show that would have me, I came on and I said, Admiral Turner, where are you? Come on out. I want to just talk to you. You know, just come on camera. You know, I'm used to... Instead, what happened is out comes this little wind-up guy, James Woolsey. I mean, have you ever seen James Woolsey? Yeah. I mean, if he came up out of your lawn at night, you wouldn't even think twice. Jesus. Well, he's a, James Woolsey is like, he's kind of like the latest defense attorney, you know, for central intelligence. And he goes on programs like Larry King Live, and you name it. I mean, the media is open to him. And what does he say? He says, well, it was an operation gone awry, a joint operation between the CIA and mind you, I'm telling all this to the Colombian people. This is the first time they're hearing this. America's seen it on 60 Minutes. America's seen it on Good Morning America. I mean, it disappeared. How long is your attention, you know? And so this guy Woolsey is going around the country, and he's saying the drugs never hit the street. Well, meanwhile, the head of DEA, who resigned shortly after, a federal judge said he's a liar. Yes. He didn't use those words. He said that it's not true. Well, before I would say anything, because I value my reputation, I don't say anything I can't back up, nothing. Before I would talk about it, I still have people in DEA who call me all the time, because I'm much cheaper than a psychiatrist. And they are losing their minds from what they see. They're finding out how terrible, what a fraud they're in. You have to understand that DEA basically are American people who have families with drug problems, who have been propagandized just as I was for many years, and they're good people. And what happens is it takes them years. I didn't know until my first assignment was in Bangkok, Thailand, undercover. I was living with Chinese drug dealers in 1971. It was during the Vietnam War. Chinese drug dealers invited me to a place where they make heroin in a place called Chiang Mai. Enter the CIA. They kill the case. I'm brought into the American embassy. All of this was in a book, by the way. Don't buy the book. I hate the book. It was in a book by an Englishman by the name of Donald Goddard called Undercover. I'm telling you the story, but I don't buy the book. In the embassy, I'm told for the first time in my career, our country has other priorities. Just chill out. And now you arrest the people you met and go back to the U.S., and the case is over. I later learned that the people that the CIA was protecting was part of a ring that was smuggling heroin in the dead bodies of GIs being transshipped across Vietnam. Now, how can you believe that? How could a guy with a brother who's a heroin addict believe this? How could I? I couldn't accept that. It wasn't until I was sent to South America that it was inescapable. And all the details are in the book. I mean, I can't go through the whole book now. I want to give you guys a chance to ask questions. But what else I told the Colombian people was the following. I lived alongside of this woman who was named the Queen of Cocaine by Pablo Escobar. I found out that she was named that because she was selling Pablo Escobar, of course, and Pablo Escobar was being supplied by the CIA. I found out that our government put us undercover in a house in Tucson, a luxury house in Tucson, Arizona. I was passing, pretending to be her business partner, her lover. I see eyes going up. You believe me, everything was on hidden video cameras. There was nothing. And besides, she, all the time she was working with me, was a CIA asset. She was selling drugs while she was with me, working on Colombian drug dealers. Among the Colombian drug dealers was a woman called Ana Tomayo. Ana Tomayo was one of the famous extraditables. And this is a very important part in the book for people who are following Colombia, because Ana Tomayo was painted by the American government as a major member of the Medellin, a deadly woman, a member of the Medellin cartel. She was nothing but what they call a comisionista. She wasn't even a drug dealer. She was someone who made a commission on selling, on putting together buyers and sellers. She was arrested because they stopped me from going after the main guy. Why? That's up to you guys to demand the answer. Instead, she was one of the extraditables brought in like a sacrificial lamb. And you guys were told here we go. Colombia's fighting back. Colombia didn't know. The charges were leveled against her here in the U.S. I knew. But by this time in my life, they had me under investigation. My daughter at this time became a drug addict, and I made a deal. I keep my mouth shut, and they transferred me back to New York to fight my daughter's drug war. And if it wasn't for the events that happened in 1987, where I wrote about them in Deep Cover, which came first, the book came first, but the events happened backwards. The Big White Lie happened first, because I never thought I would tell. You know, I never thought I would tell, because when I tried to, America doesn't move. American people don't do anything. I'm telling you, you're being ripped off. I'm telling you that when Alfonso D'Amato, the senator, said before a congressional hearing that it's mind-boggling. We tax Americans billions to fight drugs, and we're in bed with the drug dealers. I'm telling you it's true. I put it down for you.
Michael Levine, former DEA agent and author of Deep Cover. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Jeff Cohen. He's Executive Director of FAIR, that's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a media watch group based in New York, and they are celebrating their 10th anniversary. Happy birthday, Jeff.
Thank you.
Well, before we talk about FAIR and all that you've done over the last 10 years, I want to talk about tonight, about the last presidential debate. Yes, once again, it'll be moderated by Jim Lehrer of the Jim Lehrer News Hour, and those debating, Bob Dole, representing the Republicans, and Bill Clinton, the Democrats. Your comments.
Well, the problem with the debates as I see them is what doesn't get probed, especially by a fellow like Jim Lehrer, are the issues where Clinton and Dole are not that far apart, but the American people is really concerned. For example, the majority of the American people are not, quote, free traders. The majority of the American people were against NAFTA and remain against NAFTA. So what you have in Clinton and Dole is militant supporters of NAFTA and GATT and the right of corporations to go around the world looking for cheaper labor, with Perot excluded from the debates, with Ralph Nader excluded from the debates. You basically have something that could be very interesting if a moderator were creative enough to probe the issue. But since Clinton and Dole agree, and Lehrer is not the most deft interrogator, that issue's virtually off the table. Another has been corporate welfare. Clinton and Dole basically agree on the issue. It's something the American people are very concerned about. Clinton and Dole also are basically supportive of a military budget that gives the Pentagon billions of dollars for weapons systems that even the Pentagon didn't even ask for, and that hasn't been probed. So I'm not optimistic about what's going to happen tonight, but let's face it, the fact that there's 120 people that aren't Jim Lehrer might mean that some of these questions will be asked tonight that weren't in the previous two debates.
Let's talk not only about corporate welfare, but about corporate crime. You have on Monday Archer Daniels Midland agreeing to pay $100 million, the largest criminal antitrust fine in history, to the U.S. Treasury to plead guilty to fixing the prices of some of its products. And you have them involved not only with one or two of the people who will be on the stage tonight, but all three, the moderator as well as the presidential candidates.
Well, that again is is the ultimate indictment of what's wrong with our political process and what's wrong with our media. Archer Daniels Midland is a major political player, not just a corporate criminal, a major player in politics, has been for decades one of the biggest givers to both political parties, especially the Republicans and especially Bob Dole. And besides, when Archer Daniels Midland, they're the huge grain company. They produce most of the country's ethanol. They're the main lobbyists for sugar supports. Why? Because if the price of sugar can be kept up, then Archer Daniels Midland can keep selling its sugar substitute, like corn sweetener, corn syrup. So, I mean, they're basically involved. There's not an issue that Archer Daniels Midland isn't involved in politically, trade, taxes, agricultural concerns, subsidies. And when they give money to both political parties, and Duane Andreas, the chair of Archer Daniels Midland, gives to both parties big money, they're giving to both political parties because they want to narrow the policy options that are debated in Washington. And when they give big money to the news media, they're trying to narrow the debate within the media and blunt any questions that might probe corporate power. So Archer Daniels Midland gives millions and millions of dollars yearly, several million dollars yearly, to the Lehrer NewsHour. They also give a big sum to National Public Radio. And when our colleague at FAIR, Norman Solomon, tried to find out how big that sum was that Archer Daniels Midland gives to National Public Radio, the attitude at National Public Radio is that the public has no right to know how much so-called public radio is getting from Archer Daniels Midland. Our ADM also is a big funder of all of the weekend shows, McLaughlin's One-on-One, This Week with David Brinkley. Over the years, they've also sponsored Meet the Press on NBC, Face the Nation on CBS. They funded them all. So it's significant that ADM is now a major corporate criminal, and it's only because this big settlement, this deal where they're pleading guilty, is happening this week, that the name Archer Daniels Midland will probably come up tonight. But the point is that Archer Daniels Midland should be coming up on all of these political shows week after week after week because they're major players in all of these policy issues. And I think one thing that's coming out in the last couple days is that Senator Dole is basically the senator from ADM. He's used the corporate jet dozens of times. The chair of ADM, Duane Andreas, helped Dole get a condo in Florida at favorable terms. He's received, Dole and his political committees have received, I think, a couple hundred thousand dollars from ADM over the years. So Dole once said, "I'm not embarrassed about being the senator from ADM." But I think the significance is that unless an issue, and this is the main fault that FAIR has found for years with the mainstream media, unless an issue comes crashing into the mainstream media so that they cannot ignore it, like this major guilty plea, ADM and corporate welfare would have been off the agenda. And again, the same thing with Clinton. If it weren't for these big donations from a conglomerate in Indonesia, that is, so big it can't be ignored, the issue of campaign finance has basically been off the presidential campaign agenda. And I think part of the problem is that Lehrer is the moderator of the debates. He's part of the problem. He's part of the establishment. He's part of the reason that these questions never get posed.
I mean, you have to look at any debate moderator or even reporters when there's a panel of reporters at these debates, because in fact how it works is that the debaters themselves, the candidates themselves, select and veto who they want to question
right.
them. So you're ultimately going to end up with people that they don't feel threatened by who will ask them difficult questions.
Right. I think the way to look at these debates is the candidates really don't have to worry too much about their answers if they've already determined the questions. And, you know, there's an old line, when we think about the fact that the debate has excluded Perot, who was anti-NAFTA and who does talk about campaign finance, albeit in his deformed way, or you talk about the exclusion of Ralph Nader, it brings to mind what Boss Tweed used to say, which is, you know, we don't care who the voters are as long as we do the nominating. And, you know, if you've narrowed the choice to two candidates and then you've narrowed the questioners to Jim Lehrer, you really, if you're say, a corporate powerhouse that wants the real issues not discussed in the media, you've basically already got the deal signed, sealed, and delivered.
Do you think it would have made an enormous difference for Ralph Nader to be in these debates? And what about your coverage of the media coverage of the Green Party presidential candidate?
Oh, I think it would have been made a major difference. I think all of these issues that have not been debated, free trade, corporate welfare, the bloated military budget, campaign finance, they would have been unavoidable with Nader in the debate. And, you know, we've been following the coverage of Nader. He's admittedly running an unorthodox effort. He's, in a sense, hardly campaigning. On the other hand, what we've noticed over the months is that back in April, when CBS and LA Times included Nader in their national polls, Nader was getting 6%, 8%. And then, and by the way, he was on no ballots back in April. As the months have gone on, and he got on first a few ballots, then 5, 10, 15 state ballots, the national media quit including Nader in the polling, to the point where, if you might have known in April he was running, by July and August, when the conventions are going on, you forgot that Nader was even an option. So I think the mass media have done a job on helping to marginalize Nader, and frankly, he would have represented a major threat to the powers that be if they had given him fair treatment, because he is hugely popular with millions of Americans.
And the threat to the media that he represents?
Well, the media have an odd relationship with Nader. It's something we've looked at. I mean, you know, decades ago, he was somewhat of a hero to the average reporter. And as time has gone on, I've sensed this attitude. I'm talking about the elite journalists at Time and Newsweek and New York Times and Washington Post and the TV networks and CNN. You know, their attitude seems to be, well, we've conformed. What's wrong with Ralph? Or why doesn't he get with the program? Or when is the guy going to ever, you know, get a sense of humor? And I think there's this attitude about and against Ralph Nader, which is, you know, we grew up. Why can't he? He's still banging his head against the wall. And I've sensed that in so much of the coverage of him. He's sort of a nuisance to them. He's like a conscience that a lot of elite reporters, they wish he would just go home and go away. And I think the treatment of Nader has been truly astounding to me. And again, I know he's running a strange campaign. When you talk to mainstream reporters, they say he's not out on the campaign trail. He's not doing the basic things that presidential candidates do. The fact is, Perot was covered day after day after day with his millions of dollars to throw around. And in the polls, even though Nader didn't have the millions of dollars, a lot of the polls, even up to a month ago, you know, Perot was at about 5% and Nader was at about 4%. None of the other third-party candidates had cracked anywhere near 1%. So I think an argument could have been made that the mainstream media, if they had any semblance of fairness and independence, they would have said, well, let's focus on these four candidates, Democrat, Republican, Nader, and Perot. But that's not what they're doing.
Jeff, as you look back on your 10 years with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, what do you consider your greatest failures and your greatest victories?
Well, our achievements, as many Pacifica listeners know, our achievements are that we waged a campaign where we very much hurt the credibility of Rush Limbaugh. Our surveys of his reign of error have been published in hundreds of dailies. The point of view that of middle-of-the-road Americans that Rush Limbaugh is a font of disinformation is in large part a result of FAIR's work. We also were the first group that monitored hate talk radio and militia radio, and we were doing that months before Oklahoma City. So I think we've done a good job of delegitimizing talk radio. while these media monopolies are more powerful than they've ever been, there's also a growing minority of Americans who don't trust the corporate-owned media. And they've begun to understand that NBC is owned by GE and CBS is owned by Westinghouse, and those two companies between them are involved in the manufacture of 80% of the world's nuclear reactors. And they know you can't trust the information about nuclear power from the media conglomerate. So I think there's been a delegitimizing that FAIR has played a major role in. And obviously we haven't in any way broken the back of the trend toward monopoly. In fact, it's much worse now than it was 10 years ago. But I think we've helped raise consciousness amongst a minority of Americans that you can't trust the corporate-owned media, that a few conglomerates have taken over the media, and if you want to understand what's really going on in the country, you have to look to alternative media. That's a big victory for us, this change in consciousness. Remember that 10 years ago, when FAIR was formed, almost all of the criticism that received a mainstream audience, all the media criticism was basically the conservative claim that we have a, quote, liberal media, unquote. And I think FAIR has done a lot to change that, that in many of the debates about media, there are both sides, and a progressive critique of the media often gets into the debate. 10 years ago, before FAIR was formed, the only critique of the media that reached a mainstream audience was the right-wing critique. So we're happy that we've shifted the debate a little bit.
And you all at FAIR have paid a personal price for your attack on right-wing radio. Steve Rendell, one of your senior researchers, was just attacked this weekend.
Yeah, Steve has been our most visible figure in denouncing the racist bigotry that comes from the most powerful talk show host in New York, Bob Grant, and he's now nationally syndicated, Bob Grant. And Steve was attacked from the back. He was knocked over and knocked on his face by people, two assailants who then ran off, and they had made a reference to, I'll have to prettify it for the airwaves, you know, don't screw with Bob, which we have taken to be a reference to Bob Grant, and we made a police report on that. I mean, when we started taking on talk radio, we have been subjected to threats of violence on a regular basis. And so, I mean, there's no doubt that there is a strong right-wing, in some ways almost a proto-fascist constituency that has been aroused by right-wing talk radio, another forum, by the way, that doesn't really allow progressives or progressive populists to challenge the right wing. And we've been victims of a lot of threats, and what happened last week was the first physical assault. And you know, and we're victims in other ways. When you attack the media with the documentation that we do and with the persistence that we do, it's often hard for us to be invited on some of these same programs that we've attacked. In the whole 10 years of FAIR, we have never gotten on the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour, and I have heard from producers there that we're basically on a blacklist. At CNBC, which is owned by General Electric and which was presided over by Roger Ailes, the Republican strategist, for a couple years, we couldn't get on CNBC, and especially during the time that we were promoting our book called The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error. And Roger Ailes is the executive producer of Rush Limbaugh's television show. So, I mean, we know what blacklisting is all about. When you have our perspective and you're tough media critics, you just don't get on the air like you should.
Well, I still commend the studies you did of McNeil-Lehrer and Nightline, showing what, of course, we all knew, but it's so important to get the documentation down. The overwhelming majority of people, of course, white male, right, corporate executives or political leaders. And one of the most frequent guests on Nightline was his own, Ted Koppel's own dear friend, Henry Kissinger.
Right. And, you know, when we've done these studies, this is another thing that we think of as a major victory. These studies that we've done of the guest list, of the major mainstream talk shows on television, those studies are covered in hundreds of mainstream dailies. And when we put out our study of Nightline, which showed the four most frequent guests were Henry Kissinger, Alexander Haig, Elliot Abrams, and Jerry Falwell. Falwell was asked to give his expertise about AIDS. When you look at those kinds of numbers and you get it out to the journalists, the TV critics, who are hungry for an explanation of why these shows are so boring, why they're Tweedledee-Tweedledum, we got major coverage. Columnists were referring to Nightline as White Line. And McNeil Lehrer was really damaged by the major publicity that our study got. And our study showed that when McNeil Lehrer discussed the environment in discussions in their studio, they basically excluded representatives of environmental groups. And I was once asked to debate McNeil the night the study was released, the FAIR study on their guest list. And I kept pressing Robert McNeil. I said, how can you discuss the environment by excluding representatives of environmental groups? And after I asked the question five times, his answer was, well, we do sometimes consult with environmentalists off the air. And that was the best he could do. So, I mean, I think that's another victory, that when people think who gets to speak on TV and who doesn't, and even mainstream TV critics, they all come to our numbers because we're the only group that's done these studies.
Jeff Cohen, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Jeff Cohen, Executive Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It is 10 years old. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, a look back and a look ahead. It is the first anniversary of the Million Man March. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the one-year anniversary of the Million Man March, the historic event organized by the Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan that brought hundreds of thousands of African-American men, a million African-American men, to a rally in the nation's capital.
Brothers, as you know, we are assembled here so that we might once again resume our responsibilities as husbands and fathers and black men in our community. Part of this holy day of atonement and reconciliation.
Did Minister Farrakhan organize the march? No, Clarence Thomas and Gingrich organized the march, just like Bull Connor organized the march in 1963.
And why are you so surprised we're here?
We told you it was gonna be awesome, but we were wrong. It is awesome plus.
Would you welcome with love, Rosa Parks?
There's no chance of world salvation unless the conversation's peace.
I love you, and God, God bless you.
Now, when they go back, the hottest ticket in the ghetto would be the brothers that didn't come. The Lions say they was there. I was there, baby. And let me tell you what it was like.
The pit has been dark and the walls have been steep. But today, voices of old spirit sound speak to us in words profound.
And let's not let Willie Lynch lynch our new spirit and our new attitude and our new mind. Except in self-defense, I say your name from this day forward.
I will never abuse my wife by striking her,
disrespecting her, for she is the mother of my children.
Of my future.
Flashbacks from the Million Man March 1 year ago today. Thanks to WPFW Program Director Lou Hankins for that mix. Joining us now to talk about the impact of that march on the African-American community and on the Black political agenda are our co-host Salimu Akil in Chicago. He is senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times, and Professor Manning Marable, author of Beyond Black and White, and he is a professor at Columbia University in New York. Salim?
Dr. Marable.
Oh, I think you can call me Manning Salim. That's quite all right.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing fine, my brother.
All right. Look, you know, they're having a World Day of Atonement today in New York City, in your city, as a sort of follow-up of the march. And I think what it does is it's a vague attempt, you know, what I think he's calling, what Louis Farrakhan is calling for is an end to murder, to world murder or something like that. It's kind of a vague appeal in much the same way that the march was a vague appeal, but that the vagueness attracted a lot of people. But in the aftermath, many people are saying that the possibility, the potential for a truly united front to attack the various ills that afflict African Americans has been absolutely squandered by Louis Farrakhan's brand of leadership.
That's absolutely true. Black nationalism as an ideology has always had a dual face. There's a progressive black nationalism, and there's a reactionary and conservative black nationalism. Sometimes in the same movement, say in the Garvey movement in the 1920s, you found both characteristics. In the Nation of Islam, you have essentially a conservative, patriarchal, homophobic, African-American nationalist movement. And it has historically never had the capability or the practice of constructing a broad-based black united front. Now, the structure, the conduit through which that could have occurred was the National African-American Leadership Summit. But we've seen over the past year...
Benjamin Chavis's group.
That's right. But we've seen over the past year, especially culminating in the meeting in St. Louis several weeks ago, the inability to consolidate a genuine front.
And that inability has been laid to what some say is Louis Farrakhan's kind of authoritative leadership style, the fact that he gets divine leadership and really has no need to consult with others in a national united front. But why is Chavis? Why do you think Benjamin Chavis, who has a history of progressive involvement, why do you think he's been drawn into this?
I think that for two reasons. One, that once Chavis lost his position in the NAACP, he fell back to a process which he had actually initiated beginning in June of 1994. I attended the meeting and was invited, but the process was to reach out to black leadership across the country to create a broad-based process of dialogue and cooperative action. Now, in principle, this thing could have evolved into something like A. Philip Randolph's Negro National Congress of the 1930s, but it failed miserably for several reasons. One, Chavis had endorsed, after all, NAFTA, and he had alienated black trade unionists throughout the country. The two institutions you need to build a black united front are black labor and the black church. On labor, Chavis has never had a good working relationship.
Why did he endorse NAFTA?
Oh, that's a long discussion. Some people say because he was taken by private car from Baltimore to the White House, where Al Gore sat down with him and convinced him to do it, even though the NAACP's national board told him not to. But be that as it may, after Chavis lost the NAACP position, he felt that his own credibility and his future as a major black figure in the movement rested with Farrakhan. Part of that is a financial relationship, but the broad part of that is a political one. In a sense, as Ben surrendered his position of independence, semi-independence in the NAACP, he became dependent politically on Farrakhan.
Mm-hmm. Well, one reason for that, though, Manning, is the lack of any ideological alternative to Farrakhan's brand of nationalism.
Absolutely.
Is there any attempt by progressives like yourself to develop some sort of ideological response to opposition in these days?
Yes. I think in several ways. First, through a rigorous critique of the contradictions of conservative black nationalism. I think that at the St. Louis meeting, for example, on the last day, in a very bizarre situation, you get Farrakhan's people putting forward, at least as a possible speaker, Lyndon LaRouche. Now, LaRouche...
I heard about that.
I beg your pardon?
I did hear about that.
Yeah,
I couldn't
right.
believe it at first.
It's hard to believe. But, you know, Lyndon LaRouche is a familiar enemy, a familiar figure as a pivotal enemy of the black freedom struggle in the last 15, 20 years. He was hired by the South Africans to do a report assessing anti-apartheid movement in the U.S. in the late 70s. In the 80s, he organized a rally in Washington, D.C. That brought together a pseudo-homage to Martin Luther King Jr., plus a demand for Reagan's Star Wars. They said, "I have a dream and build the beam." In 1992, James Bevel, who is a veteran civil rights activist of long standing but unfortunately has drifted to the far right, was LaRouche's running mate on a far right-wing presidential campaign. It's the same LaRouche that the Nation of Islam in the last year has begun to cozy up to. And you can see this in reading their literature.
We could have seen it in Bevel's growing influence within the Nation of Islam, because Bevel, Farrakhan, and Minister Farrakhan, in fact, has credited Bevel with helping him define and formulate the idea for the Million Man March.
Absolutely. And as I recall, when Farrakhan went to Libya most recently, Bevel traveled with him.
He did
so
indeed.
Bevel is really the linchpin between LaRouche, Farrakhan, and unfortunately Ben Chavis. They have a lot of explaining to do, because this is not simply conservative, white conservatism of the brand of a George Bush, or even, frankly, of a Robert Dole. This is a fascist movement.
Or a Jack Kemp, who recently
exactly.
spoke well of Louis Farrakhan.
Exactly. This is a fascist movement in a classical sense. But once again, black nationalism has a reactionary and a revolutionary character. Reactionary black nationalism, I mean... Think about 1921-22. Garvey did speak to white supremacists, and the principle was that white racists would at least tell you the truth. And so you both can agree on racial separatism. You can both agree on a political economy of capitalism. Louis Farrakhan's political economy is no different from Booker T. Washington's. It's just updated to the late 20th century. His strategy of racial separatism could be embraced by a LaRouche. So,
but Manny, wasn't there an opportunity, and wasn't there some thought that Louis Farrakhan was indeed changing his views and becoming a bit more progressive and accommodating himself to the demands, the various demands of the black community?
There was a view of this, but I think that the approach we should take as progressives is the dual character of black nationalism. Even of conservative black nationalism. For example, in mid-September, Farrakhan and a group of 20 NOI members toured Cuba. Now, I've read Grandma's and the newspaper of Cuba and the reports from Cuba, and Farrakhan supports the progressive position that we should oppose the U.S. embargo of Cuba and calls, and in fact, actually, toured Cuba, looked at their health systems, their educational systems, and saw those as models for what we might emulate in the United States. And on that, he's absolutely correct. So we can't simply say, as some critics on the left have said, that everything Farrakhan says must be opposed. That's counterproductive. We have to see the complex character of what this movement represents, and also why it resonates so profoundly among a sector of the urban poor, and the hip-hop generation.
Manning, did you change your view of the Million Man March before, during, and after it happened?
Not really. I mean, from the very beginning, and if people in New York read the pages of the Amsterdam News, I was very involved in a debate about the character of the march. My basic view was there was a reason for to march, but not around this agenda. And I had serious criticisms of the patriarchy, the homophobia, the focus, the moralistic character of it. Not resistance, but atonement. Well, if anybody needs to atone, it's the U.S. ruling class, not African-American people. We've atoned enough for the damage the system has done to us. So I felt that the whole orientation was flawed just very profoundly. And what's happened since then is that the nucleus, especially that expressed through the National African American Leadership Summit, has begun to truncate even further. I mean, if you look at the Leadership Summit, there are about 200 organizations involved in it, but the vast majority of them reflect the black middle class, the nationalist-oriented middle class. You have professional associations like Black Engineers, Black Social Workers, fraternities, sororities. There's nowhere in the structure for labor, for feminist organizations, for gay and lesbian organizations, for left or socialist organizations, nothing that represents the broad spectrum of black social and political thought in the country.
But the march, so in fact, the spirit of the march did include many of those sentiments that you talked about, Manning.
But they have fallen away since then. You know?
Well, they were hijacked essentially by another agenda. Mm-hmm. And as you point out, it seems that the people who came for those other reasons have been left stranded without any sort of organizational response to their urges.
That's absolutely true. And so, therefore, I think that what you're pointing to is the need for something that is on the left or something left of center, to use the popular phrase today, that is genuinely black, that is grounded in the political culture of the African-American community, that speaks not an esoteric language of sectarianism, but a language people that resonates in people's lives, that talks to people around issues they see every day, from community to issues of gender, to issues of the workplace and labor. And such a structure, the space for such an organization does exist. The question is, objectively, what are activists and veterans of the movement prepared to do to make it so? Until there is something on the left, then people, young people, will naturally gravitate to Farrakhan because he's the only game in town.
The only oppositional voice.
That's right.
And what do you think people who have other ideas about this should be doing? How should black progressives how should they be organizing themselves?
Well, there's a regroupment process that's already really occurring. Some of that has occurred in Chicago around this Ida B. Wells group that's been formed. Some of it has occurred in New York over the last year, where a group of us have met to create the Ida B. Wells W.E.B. Du Bois Network, which is a group of black scholars, writers, artists, journalists, activists who are holding forums, who are engaged in dialogue, and who are trying to bring together activist theory and practice for a progressive movement. I think part of that is going to occur nationally within the next year with the linking up of these various discussion groups. But I think that we need to move very soon to there is not in the United States anything that parallels race and class. In the UK, a publication that articulates a race, gender, class perspective that actually serves as a theoretical and organizational tool of the black left. We need something like that in the United States.
Manny Maribel, I see that on October 19th, you're going to be holding a big forum up at Columbia University.
That's right. It's a forum on the African-American community and the 1996 presidential election, which way forward. It'll be held at Columbia University at 7:30 this Saturday night. But I think that these kinds of forums and dialogues are absolutely essential for the regroupment of the black left to occur. And the reason that the politics in the black community has steered so far to the right toward chauvinism, toward sexism, toward homophobia, is because there is not a clear left voice that articulates a progressive democratic alternative.
Manning Maribel, as we wrap up, the phone number, if people want to reach your institute up at Columbia, the Institute for Research in African American Studies,
is area code 212-854 212-854-7080.
That's 212-854-7080. And we've been speaking with Professor Manning Marable, heads up the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. And Salim, thanks very much for being with us. Salim Wakil, my co-host, a senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer has been Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
WPFW, 89.3 FM.
Washington Daylight Time, 9 hours, 59 minutes, 15 seconds. Universal Time, 13 hours, 59 minutes, 20 seconds. U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock. At the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 9 hours, 59 minutes, 30 seconds. Universal Time, 13 hours, 59 minutes, 35 seconds. U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock. At the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 9 hours, 59 minutes, 45 seconds. Universal Time, 13 hours, 59 minutes, 50 seconds.